Broadcasting live from Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn, you're listening to HeritageRadioNetwork.com.
I'm Sam Edwards. I'm third generation cure master from S. Wallace Edwards & Sons in Surrey, Virginia. We support the Heritage Radio Network because we believe in the cause and what they're doing. They're supporting family-raised livestock, small family farms, certified humane, pasture-raised, antibiotic-free. Basically, we take the products from Heritage Foods USA and make them into Serrano-style hams, prosciutto-style hams, bacon, sausage, like my grandfather did. You can find us at Surrey Farms. .com or virginiatraditions.com.
All right, it's Thursday, 1 o'clock, and you are tuned into the Heritage Radio Network. You're listening to The Farm Report, and I am your host, Aaron Fairbanks. And today we want to welcome back Jesse LaFlamme of Pete and Jerry's. Jesse, welcome back to the show. Thanks for coming on again.
Hey, thank you for having me.
Awesome. So what's happening up in Monroe, New Hampshire? How's the weather? It's a little gloomy here.
Yeah, it's snowing right now. It's starting to get cold. We've been so lucky, but now it's changing. Winter's here.
I know. I say it's like hard to complain about the nice weather, but there is something that feels kind of wrong.
True. Very true.
So we had you on the show back in December where we learned a ton about the work you guys do up at Pete and Jerry's producing eggs. And I wanted to bring you back on because as we moved our way through the show, I realized I just have kind of a ton more questions for you. So I think we're going to probably skip around a little bit today and touch on a couple of the things that I think got left out of the first show. So I'm going to just jump right in. Are you ready?
Sure.
Awesome. So one of the things we were talking about last time was the barns and how you guys have moved away from raising the, or maybe you guys never did actually do cage-raised hens. And I was just wondering if you could talk a little bit about why is it that that is the preferred model versus doing, you know, chickens roaming in an open barn or out on pasture for the industrial model? Like why do people choose caging? Because it seems a little unclear to me anyway.
Yeah, no, that's a very good question. And I actually, we did have caged chickens at one time. That's what I kind of grew up with. When I was much younger, so I'm very familiar with what it looks like and how it operates and why. And it's true. I mean, the vast majority of egg laying hens in this country are kept in battery style cages, is what they call them. And I think, you know, I mentioned last time that these things just keep getting bigger and bigger. Where the largest that I've heard of is 650,000 chickens in one barn, but a lot of them are being built, you know, 250,000 chickens in one barn. And they're sort of skyscrapers inside of a big shed. They have catwalks between the levels, and, you know, there'll be 12 levels of cages high. And really the reason that the egg industry, egg production has gone that way, a couple reasons. One of them, you know, it's management. The hens can't go anywhere. They can't do anything. It's incredibly controlled environment. I mean, they know exactly how much grain they're putting out in front of them. Can't put out too much, you know, not putting out too little. Climate control, I mean, everything's sort of mechanical and down to an exact science. So it takes, you know, less of the nuances that farmers generally have in terms of, you know, the relationship with their animals. The other component is that, you know, there are so few egg farmers in the country now because the segment of farming is just consolidated, you know, where a small farm has almost a million hens now. You know, it allows these farmers or agribusinesses to have huge concentrated operations and just have massive output. So those are really kind of the two main reasons why it's gone to cages. And we found, you know, chickens, I guess they still lay eggs in cages in this industrialized system, so we've kind of, again, in my opinion, pushed it way too far, but they've pushed it to the limit on industrializing and getting away from traditional farming methods.
Right. So, I mean, essentially, it's still, you're kind of testing the limits of what the animal can really endure and pushing that to the maximum as far as, you know, production really being the main goal. Is you'll go as far as you can go as long as the eggs are still being produced in a reasonable volume. What about the process of debeaking? We didn't touch on that at all last time, but that is something I feel like you hear a lot about is farms choosing to debeak their chickens. And is that an issue for egg layers and for meat birds, or is it just more for one type of bird than the other?
It is. It's more of an issue, and that's another good question because people have a lot of concerns about this, and there's a lot of misinformation. It's a bigger issue for egg layers than it is for the meat chickens, and the practice has changed a lot. It kind of got the name debeaking back in the day because it was really awful and severe, and that's changed some. Not all companies have changed their practices, and some do it quite severely, and it's going to sound horrible, but they actually use it to control the feed intake of the hens. They sort of make it harder for them to eat a lot of grain. It's pretty horrible. And that's sort of debeaking. What's generally done as a practice now is beak trimming.
Okay.
And it's actually, I'm not trying to play with semantics here and things. There really is kind of a difference, and there really is a difference. And it's actually, just again, full disclosure, to be honest, it's a practice that we use, and not because we want to, and it's an expense and other things, but it's actually a practice that's approved and advised by Certified Humane, by Humane Farm Animal Care, and virtually all the humane organizations that approve egg production.
Right.
But it has to be done at 10 days of age or less.
Okay.
That's the critical issue. So at that point, the beak on a hen is not hardened yet, completely hardened yet. There's, nerve endings aren't completely formed, things like that. And it's also the practice has to be done a certain way where it's just the very, very, very sharp tip of the beak. And most people, don't realize that the chickens will very often have if the beak isn't trimmed, it's actually almost like a hook, like an eagle's beak, if you can imagine.
Yeah.
As wonderful as chickens are, I mean, they're awesome, but it is a little bit of a school playground, even in a cage-free and even in a free-range, true pastured environment. There's a hierarchy, and there can be some bullies. There's those type A personalities, that I see that love to run outside first thing in the morning. They also like to let their neighbors know who's boss. And so they can really gang up on a chicken that might either be a little smaller, look a little funny, her comb isn't quite as big as the others. They can really kind of be mean to her. So by removing that really sharp and just the very sharp tip, 10 days of age or less, they can do far, far less harm. And that's why it's sort of been approved and recommended by these humane agencies.
Right. And I mean, I think that is a really common practice across all aspects of livestock, whether it's, trimming tails or looking at horns and kind of different ways of creating a system that's a little bit easier to manage when you're raising animals in a larger than kind of backyard scenario. And I know I've definitely seen, I think, both varieties of the debeaking, where you have a more extreme and a less extreme. To me, I guess it always looked like, women who have really long kind of scary fingernails, and then maybe if you just trim the tip of that was kind of
right. Well, that's the analogy that we try to give to people, is that, in terms of what it does to the chick. I'm not a chick who's had this done, but I can tell you I've observed a lot of it, and what happens, that the tip is trimmed. And then the chick is set down on the ground, and it's amazing to watch them just, they'll either run right over. They look completely unaffected. They'll run right over to the water, and they'll tap on the water, or they'll run and eat, with that tip that was just trimmed. So in my mind, it's, they're not showing pain in any way. They're not showing a change in behavior. So, I feel okay about it. I feel
right.
good about it, that we're not harming them.
And is that something that you have someone on the farm who's trained to do, or do you have to bring in someone outside the farm to do that process for you?
We actually have somebody, we used to have somebody outside come in. We actually trained somebody inside the farm because we really wanted to control it and make sure it was done right. So we brought that process to our inside, which has been good.
And as you said, that is part of, you guys are certified humane, and it's nice, I think, to have organizations like that who have really taken the time to look at how those types of practices impact the animals. And I think for us as consumers, you know, you hear kind of in the news, the horse stories. And so it's, I think, important to differentiate the levels of the process. And then I think also really encourage people to you know, find a farm where they can visit and evaluate the process for themselves and make a choice based on that. Moving on, I wanted to talk about, I think that you said in the barns where the chickens spend kind of most of their life, the floor is covered with, is it wood shavings or what is the ground?
Yeah, it's actually a combination of two surfaces, really. There's a slatted area, which is usually underneath feeders and waterers and that sort of thing, and then there's a scratch area, which is wood shavings and sawdust, and so they're sort of two important areas. And the slatted area is also, in addition to being, you know, underneath the food and water, it's also close to the nest. So, of course, hens are not discriminant about where they poop, and the slats actually help take care of that and help clean off their feet and things, especially before they go into a nest to lay eggs. So everything drops through the slats and is taken out of the barn, actually, in most cases, twice a day. So the air is really good in there and so forth. But the scratch area is really just as critical, and that's a cool area. And we sort of have the same surface in the winter gardens that we have on our farm, which is, you know, the screened-in porch for chickens. So they, you know, that's just a huge natural behavior for chickens. I mean, they want to, and it's something that's denied chickens big time in cages. They want to scratch around. You know, they want to look for things, and, you know, and bugs and insects and weird looking, you know, whatever they can find, whatever they're curious about. So it's amazing to watch them sort of all day long. You know, they'll do rounds between nesting and feeding and roosting, and, you know, hit the scratch area and dust bathe and do all the cool things that chickens do.
Yeah, well, so they have a schedule to keep too. So
yeah, exactly. And it's that scratch area is part of the requirements of certified humane. I mean, 15%, at least 15% of the house has to be scratch area, and it's crucial. It's good.
So you mentioned that the kind of the chicken waste is removed twice a day, and I know that is kind of another one of those issues you hear a lot in the media about. Larger or, you know, medium scale operations and kind of the waste that these groups of animals create. How do you guys deal with that, and how does that compare to maybe the way some larger facilities handle the waste products from the chickens?
I will say it's definitely changing, even for the bigger facilities. They're having to do a better job just because of environmental regulations. But enforcement, a big thing too. But you do hear these, you know, ridiculous, you know, 10 million gallon lagoon that broke open and all that stuff that's still going on. I mean, it's just so massive. How do they truly deal with it in a responsible way? And of course, we're so much smaller. You know, we've developed a regional network of farmers that think our chicken manure is gold, which is, I mean, it's great. We've actually started selling it, you know, at the farm. It's not a lot of revenue, but it's something, and it's such, you know, chicken manure is just incredible fertilizer, and the nitrogen is unbelievably high, micronutrients, you know, all those great things. So it's really great for growing all types of crops and great for compost. So we're finding a good use for it. We're very lucky.
Yeah, that's nice. So how old are the hens? I mean, what's the life cycle as far as for an egg producer? And can you talk maybe a little bit about what happens in retirement?
Sure. And typically, an egg-laying hen reaches retirement 76 to 80 weeks of age. And the life cycle, and actually it takes a lot longer to raise a day-old chick up to egg-laying age than people realize. It's about between 17 and 20 weeks to raise them up where they're mature enough to start laying eggs. And they usually start laying small eggs and medium eggs, and it takes them a while to get up to the larger eggs that everybody likes and extra large and jumbo. And that's quite a bit different than the meat chicken industry, which is really amazing to me that they actually sort of have them full grown at, I think it's 7 weeks of age. And
yeah, like less than half. I mean, that's crazy.
Yeah. Yeah, and if they keep them any longer, some of them fall over and can't get back up, or they start to have trouble because that's an interesting industry. But, yeah, it takes us quite a while. And you know, honestly, it's one of the people that wouldn't think about it, but it's one of the costs of the egg is actually, you know, raising a day-old chick to the point, you know, feeding them and keeping them warm and comfortable to the point where they're laying eggs. So we then move them into the egg-laying house because it's in a different environment. There's nests and things like that that they don't have in the growing houses. And that's, you know, that's a 54 to 58-week, a little over a year and a month period that they're in there laying eggs. And then they go to retirement, which I don't know if I, you know, spoke about it last time, but our hens, because they're cage free, and especially during the summer when they're going out, they're really well feathered. They still look like good looking chickens for the most part.
Right.
At the end of that, as opposed to cage chickens that don't. So we have a couple different markets that we sell them to for meat, essentially. So they go to. One of them is for organic. They actually go for organic soup meat and broth and that type of thing, because the meat's very different than the meat chicken meat. And then the other market, they take a trip to New York, and there's it's a smaller market, but there's live markets where people want to see the hen that they're going to purchase, you know, sort of slaughtered on spot and so forth, or they buy the hen live for further lay and things. Sort of interesting market, but so that's sort of the cycle. But what happens when the hens are in the hen house, you know, that 20 to 58 week period, they're laying a lot of eggs to begin with, and the shells are, you know, dark brown and they're thick and they look great. And towards the end, the eggs start to get bigger and bigger, but the hen is basically kind of programmed to put the same amount of shell on the egg. And it's just getting bigger and bigger, so the shell gets thinner and thinner. And the hens start laying fewer and fewer eggs. So you really kind of, you know, as a farmer, you reach a point where they're just not productive anymore and they're not producing eggs that people like. I mean, it's probably one of our bigger complaints that, you know, the shells were a little bit thin this time, you know, that we might get from customers. And it's like, sorry, she was old.
Right.
So,
older. Older.
She's older. So that's when they retire.
Well, we are going to take a quick break, but when we come back, I definitely want to talk a little bit more about that grading and sizing and kind of what goes into, you know, how the shell looks and the composition of the egg. Well, so we'll be back in just a minute.
And how are things with you? I love you. But very soon it's time to go. An office job to do while I'm here writing songs for you.
You are tuned in to the Farm Report on the Heritage Radio, and we are talking eggs and chickens with Jesse LaFlamme, Pete and Jerry's. So, Jesse, before the break, you know, we were kind of talking about the life cycle of a chicken, and you mentioned as the hens grow older, the eggs get bigger. So I wanted to kind of understand that process a little bit more as far as when you go to the store, you know, eggs have grades, but then there's also sizes and can you talk about like how those differences are demarcated and then what that means as far as from the chicken, like do different chickens lay different sizes or grades and what kind of goes into those systems?
Sure. And in terms of the grade of the eggs, it's actually a well, it's a number of factors, but which includes the shell quality. You know, a low sort of sandpapery shell, you know, thin, light, ugly shell will definitely lower the grade of an egg. But it's also the big component is the freshness.
Okay.
So, you know, a grade double A egg, which we, you know, most of our eggs are, what that really amounts to is how quickly, you know, the eggs go to the supermarket from the point of lay. And, you know, with, I mean, for quality, that's critical in our mind. And that's actually determined largely by an air cell in the egg, which anybody can identify. It's usually at the fatter end of the egg, the rounder end, when you crack it, and there's a little bubble at the back end. And that starts out at about the size of a dime and grows to the size of a quarter or bigger over the course of a month and a half. So that's really the determinant there. But in terms of sizing and things like that, it's actually, a lot of people don't realize this, but it's performed by weight. So, you know, so many minimum grams of weight for a large egg, so many for an extra large, and so forth. And as I was saying, as the hens get older, they tend to progress and lay more extra large eggs and fewer medium and fewer large and then all the way up to jumbo. And, of course, some hens from day one are sort of... they might be the bigger girls in the house, and they're laying extra large from the get-go, and they might even go up to what we call super jumbos, and those are so big they're hard to get into an egg carton. Sometimes we give a lot of those away, but it's an interesting process in how you know the eggs are sized and moved. But and to your question, you know, there definitely are variations in the breeds and what size eggs they're. Sort of more inclined to lay, but a lot of it, you know, that most of them sort of aim for that that large sweet spot. But it can be changed too, depending on light stimulation. Actually, believe it or not, when we're growing the hens up to that, you know, 17-18 week period, they're growing and they're adding, you know, to their body weight, and if you stimulating them with light, which basically is convincing a bird that it's spring and it's time to start laying eggs. And if you do that a little too early, they haven't put on the body weight that they need to lay a large egg. So through the course of their life, they'll lay smaller eggs. So that's always one of the challenges in being a farmer and taking care of the hens and making sure that, you know, things are right when it's time for them to lay.
Huh. So let me make sure I'm understanding you correctly, because I have heard about essentially, you know, tricking the chickens into laying eggs by controlling the amount of light that they see throughout the course of a day. Because it is a biological process. So, I mean, if you're thinking, you know, if I'm a chicken, I don't want to, like, lay eggs in a time when it's going to be, like, dangerous for my eggs to, for my babies, basically. So you use light to control both. You can control both how they grow, but also how often are they do or don't lay. Or am I understanding that right?
Yeah, or when they, and it gets even more interesting actually when the day old chicks come in. When we first receive the chicks, they're given, it's in the first week, it's 20 hours of light in a day. It's a lot. But that slowly steps down to 8 hours as they're growing, about an hour a week. And it's amazing, but that step down actually has as much of an effect on when the hens will start laying eggs and consequently what size they will be as that sort of step up of light from 8 hours all the way up to 16 and a half, which is where they're sort of capped when they're laying through that entire lay period, which is, you know, up here the longest day of summer. So that step-up period is, it's just that. It's convincing the hen, convincing the bird that springtime is here, and it's time to start laying eggs. So that's kind of how the process works. A lot of people don't realize that.
Wow. Well, I didn't realize that it was tuned into kind of both aspects of the chicken growth and also the egg production. Well, speaking a little bit more about the eggs, you know, one of the things that I feel like you've been seeing a little bit more here in New York at the markets is pullet eggs. And I've heard them kind of upsold as like specialty eggs. And I've also heard them downsold. You know, I've seen them offered for higher prices because they're pullets. And I've also seen them offered for lower prices because they're pullets. So can you tell us a little bit about what exactly makes a pullet egg, or if that's the right terminology, and what do you guys do with them? And then, I mean, as far as from a eating standpoint, I mean, how different they might be from like a regular, you know, large egg?
Sure. Actually, to be honest, pullet eggs are my favorite, and it's completely just subjective. I don't have any background, anything to back this up, but I think they're more flavorful than other types of other sizes of eggs. And I don't know if it's just a concentration of nutrients or what, but those pullet eggs, of course, is the very first eggs that the hens are laying, and for some reason, it seems like the yolks are darker and they're just more flavorful. So, by and large, in the conventional egg industry, the pullet eggs rarely make it to market. They're usually sold as sort of undergrades and go for liquid egg processing. They're pasteurized and go into baking goods. So it's not often that the people get to see them or taste them. And they're great. They're not hugely different, but like I said, it's definitely my favorite. I mean, one thing that's funny about pullets too, they're prone to what I call misfires, which are double yolkers, and I'm sure just about everybody's familiar with those. So you might get a jumbo egg or even a kind of funny long-looking large egg every once in a while, and that's a pullet misfire where basically she dropped two yolks into the egg and made an egg out of it, which is always pretty cool. Those are also my favorite.
So as far as, just kind of thinking about the general structure of an egg, can you take us, the parts that I'm familiar with, there's a shell, obviously, there's a white, there's the yolk, there's the air sac that you mentioned, and then there's the chalazy cords, which kind of hold the egg in place. And I know in the last show you talked a little bit about cloudy whites being an indicator of freshness, but can you say if we missed any kind of physical components of the egg, and then a little bit about what those different parts represent from a biological standpoint or a nutrition standpoint? Because, I know often, diet people who are on diets are looking to eat just the whites, but then there's more nutrients in the yolk, and that's like eight questions in one, so you can take that in any direction you want.
Sure. And actually, you really did cover, your eggs. You really covered all the important components, and of course, it's always in my mind, it's always the white yolk debate. And for our eggs, we feed the flaxseed that enhances the omega-3. People always ask, do I have to eat the yolk to get the omega-3. Yeah, you do, but it's not that bad. People don't realize. Two amazing components of the egg. The white, of course, has most of the protein of the egg, and it's an amazing low calorie source of protein and one of the best proteins that you can possibly find in the world. But the yolk, it gets a bad rap, but it shouldn't. And there's the whole cholesterol thing, but of course, we found out that the cholesterol in eggs really, it's not the way people think. It's not as harmful. It's not harmful, really, in the way that people think. And there was a Harvard School of Public Health, over 10 years, 100,000 people, and they determined that an egg a day has absolutely no effect on heart disease.
No
correlation.
Harvard, really cool. Yeah, okay, I've heard of them.
Yeah, it's a huge study. It just doesn't end with a good name. It just doesn't get any better than that. So we're starting to get out about that. But the yolk, has all these incredible, polyunsaturated fats, like the good ones, and of course in our case the omega-3 fatty acids, and then it's got lutein and xanthophyll, and which we're finding is actually good for your eyes. It can actually prevent macular degeneration and all kinds of issues, so it's a great source for that. But another thing that people don't realize, and it's cool because eggs are have eggs at breakfast, is that eggs actually, and the yolk is a part of this, make you feel more satiated throughout the day. Studies have found basically if you have an egg in the morning, even just one, you're likely to consume fewer calories of food throughout the course of the day. It just makes you feel more full. So it's a really cool food. They got an unfortunate bum rap in the 80s, but
it's coming back. Yeah, so you see that, I mean, I'm sure everyone's kind of familiar with the Incredible Edible Egg slogan, and I guess it's the American Egg Council. Where is that? Are those councils? I'm kind of always a little confused as like who's behind that. And maybe, you know, we have just a few minutes here wrapping up. If you can talk a little bit about how you guys interact with an organization like that, or if there are any other kind of like, you know, policy concerns that are particular to egg producers that maybe our listeners should be aware of or thinking about.
Sure. No, it's a good question too. And I am I'm on the American Egg Board. I'm a board member now, just in the last year.
Oh, congratulations!
And I think I'm the first. Thanks. I think I'm the first. I'm the first egg producer without chickens in cages to be on the board, which is interesting. So the American Egg Board, it's actually the USDA mandated program. So, you know, if you're selling eggs from, you know, a certain number of hens, government steps in and says, okay, you have to pay. It's 10 cents for every 30 dozen eggs that you sell, and you have to contribute it towards the American Egg Board. Being that it is a government, you know, sort of administered organization, it's generally quite unbiased. It's really a good source of information. And they fund the Egg Nutrition Center, where all this kind of good research and stuff is being done, but it's very independent, too. So the American Egg Board, egg promotion, and, you know, they do all kinds of social media and partnering with chefs and just trying to educate people on eggs, you know, as good food in general. They are not allowed to favor one type of egg production, which is pretty cool. They can't say that caged egg production is better than organic or cage-free, or vice versa, for that matter. Now, that's a little hard for them to do sometimes, I'll admit, and it makes it interesting being on the board, because I'm on the board with a bunch of the people with the big cages and stuff. But they do a pretty good job with it, and in terms of promotion and education, I think they do a really good job. They're getting the word out. So it's a good source that people, you know, don't need to be suspicious of, because it is made to be unbiased by the USDA.
Interesting. Great. Well, thank you so much for coming on again. I feel like we're going to have you back, because I still have a list of like 15 questions. And it's just such a treat to chat with you. And if people want to learn more about Pete and Jerry's, they can find you at www.peteandjerrys.com. And you can find your eggs all over in the city. So you look for them in the clear plastic containers. And you've been listening to the Farm Report. Tune in next week. We have the crew from Real Time Farms in, and it should be a great show. Jesse, thanks so much for coming on. Look forward to talking with you again soon, okay?
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this program on the Heritage Radio Network. You can find all of our archived programs on heritageradionetwork.com, as well as a schedule of upcoming live shows. You can also podcast all of our programs on iTunes by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store. You can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter for up-to-date news and information. Thanks for listening.